this edition of the Perpetual Notion Machine. Nothing is more critical to listener-sponsored radio than our sense of hearing. I'm Patrick Seibel, and as your host tonight, we will investigate the science of the innermost working of our ears. Our distinguished guest is UW neuroscience professor Robert Fetteplace. His career spans research at Cambridge University in his native England, the University of Colorado, and Stanford University prior to joining the UW faculty here in Madison in 1990. He's a past Kavli Prize winner for fundamental research and was honored this year with membership in the National Academy of Sciences for studies on how hair cells in the inner ear translate the vibrations of sound into electrical signals sent to the brain. Welcome to the show. Professor, would you like to, there's so many huge advancements in hearing research lately and developments in the applications. Could you kind of guide us in from a more general perspective?
Yes, I can. Yeah, but I do call me Robert. A professor is, I feel.
Okay. Oh, thank you.
So until a few decades ago, little was known about the cellular and the molecular basis of hearing. That is how sound is converted into electrical signals in the inner ear. The sound wave comes onto the head and it enters the ear canal and causes the eardrum at the bottom to vibrate with the increase and decrease in the pressure of the sound. So for a sound of a certain frequency, the pressure will go up and down at that frequency, and that's kind of important. These vibrations are then transmitted through the bones of the middle ear, and they enter the cochlea, which is a tube, a fluid-filled tube that's embedded in the bone of the head, the temporal bone. And this tiny organ, it's called the cochlea because in higher mammals anyway, it's shaped like a snail shell, and cochlea is Greek for snail. It's about a millimeter wide, and it's 32 millimeters long in humans. So that's quite long. That's over an inch in length. And it's coiled up like a cochlea, like a snail, in order to actually pack it into the bone in a reasonable way. So the sound pressures travel through to the chambers and they trigger electrical impulses in the auditory nerve that are sent off to the brain. And these electrical impulses are the currency of the brain. But to generate that, the sound has got to be converted into electrical signals. And we've suspected for some time that the cells known as hair cells might be the key sensors that provide the conversion from sound, from the mechanical vibrations due to sound, into electrical signals.
So we've come in through the inner ear through the drum, and the large advancement is about these hair cells and the functioning of them on the inside of the cochlea. Is that right?
That is correct. Yes. Yes, and about the mechanisms of conversion from sound to electrical signals, and this is called transduction. And of course, it's unusual because it has to be extremely fast to convert high frequencies. So humans can hear at 10 kilohertz. That's 10,000 vibrations a second. So every vibration's got to be a tenth of a millisecond. That has to be detected by the hair cell. Of course, if we go to mice, they hear up to 70 or 80 kilohertz. So they have to vibrate it even faster, and the signal has still got to be converted by the hair cell.
Is this the fastest sense that we have?
It is, yes.
Just so the way that we've been able to evolve to detect predators and things like that, or?
That's correct, yes. It's the other way around, in fact, that we evolved a high frequency hearing in order to avoid the larger predators like the dinosaurs treading on us and eating us, because we were originally nocturnal animals, mammals, at least the ones we evolved from.
So the hair cells that you've got, these are actually single cells that have the function of with a the hair on the that extends from the end of the cell. Is that?
That's correct. So the hair cell has these hairs on it, 50 to 100 little hairs. They're rigid hairs, and they're all interconnected. So this cluster or bundle of hairs will all vibrate together when they're mechanically stimulated. And the thing that's amazing is they're very, very small. So the diameter of these is going to be less than the wavelength of light. You know, the wavelength of green light is half a micron, and the diameter of these will be less than half a micron. And to micron. So to give you, I don't know whether we were talking about giving a perspective. No, so a human hair would be 100 microns. A human hair on your head is 100 microns. These are less than 1 micron.
And so each cell has got a bundle of these, or are there a group of cells that work together?
Each group has got a bundle of the hairs, yes.
That's amazing that it could be measured, that you can get down to this level. In each cell, is there a range of these of size of these cells that are the range of the hairs
of the hairs that are, so the hairs are arranged in like an organ pipe fashion, so that there'll be rows. In fact, there are three rows that are small, medium sized, and large. These rows are connected. And if you push the hairs in the direction of the tallest row, this excites the cell. And if you pull it back towards the shortest row, this inhibits the cell. So the orientation is important, and the organ pipe arrangement, the staircase of the of these hairs is important.
Yeah. So are these connected where there's the frequency, are there different frequency responses, or they respond to different levels of the volume fluctuations?
So the volume is determined, will be coded in terms of how much the hairs vibrate. So the smaller they vibrate, the bigger they vibrate, the louder the sound it is. And of course, the movements are tiny, from like a 1 nanometer to 100 nanometers. This is the movement. So 100 nanometers would be the response, the vibration of the hairs to a rock concert.
I think that's one thing I wanted to ask you. I don't know if this is a good time or not, about the application of this and the sensitivity of this. Versus a lot of people, when I mentioned this interview, asked me about care of these cells and how delicate they are. Is this something that you can mention now, or should we come back to that? Or
I'm happy to mention it now. I mean, it's related to so there's another property I need to tell you about, and that's the frequency of the sound, the pitch of the sound.
Yes,
and the pitch of the sound. Is determined by how rapidly the vibration, the pressure changes in the ear canal, and of course you can have a low frequency or a high frequency sound, and the cells that detect the different frequencies will be at different positions along this length of this cochlea. So the cochlea, what the cochlea is doing, so low frequency hair cells will be at one end and high frequency hair cells will be at the other. And the cochlea is behaving like an acoustic prism. So you know a prism, Newton's prism, you put white light on it and it divides it up into the different colors which refract at different positions on a screen. So what the cochlea is doing is it's separating the frequencies. If you have a sound that's got lots of frequencies, it's separating the frequencies along its length in order to send information about the individual frequencies off to the brain. And the brain will then put these all together and reconstruct the sound, presumably. But the crucial thing about, I'm sorry, I'm talking too much. This is a
this is critical. I'm glad you've gone this way. Thank you.
Well, there are two interesting things about this, that in fact at the the animals that I've worked on, these are turtles, reptiles, birds, and mammals. They're all what are known as amniotes. That is, the way they lay their eggs are different from amphibians, and they don't have larval stages. And all these amniotes have the same kind of cochlea. It's what's termed in the zoology homologous. It's an homologous organ. In the turtle, it's very short. In the bird, it's intermediate. The turtle is about a millimeter. The bird is about 4 millimeters. And then mammals go up from 6 to 32 millimeters in length. But they all do the same separation of frequencies. It's called a tonotopic organization, where different frequencies are spread out along the organ. And if you're talking about, perhaps we could come back to this later, but the thing about loud sounds and rock concerts is it's the high frequency sounds that go first. And they go first because they're more sensitive.
Are those further up in the front of the cochlea or in the back?
They're at the bottom. So as the snail winds up towards its tip, the tip is where the low frequencies are. And the base is where the high frequencies are.
So with the amphibian or the reptiles or the are those animals easier to study then as a
yes
versus so, mammals?
Yes. Yeah, so when I first got into this, it was clear there were two things that were the problem. That there was a mechanical problem, that because the cells are so sensitive, to get into them, access to them, you've got to break bone and stuff, and by the time you've done all of that, they no longer work. But more importantly, they are sensitive to the lack of oxygen. They're what's called metabolically sensitive, and it's a huge thing in hearing loss, that if you deprive the ear of oxygen, the cells will all die. Now, the turtle was unusual in that it's insensitive to lack of oxygen. It can stay under water for a week, and because it can metabolize anaerobically, and so that's why we picked the turtle, because the cells would stay functional, and in fact they did, and that's allows us to study the transduction mechanism. But that's the same in the turtle as it is in the mouse and the chicken and humans.
So you actually look at the dynamic responses at this microscopic level?
Yes. You mean the mechanical responses, the vibrations?
Yes. Yes.
Yes, we do. We look at the vibrations of the hairs, and we measure the electrical responses in the cells to the vibration of the hairs.
So this must be some incredible advances in analytical techniques to enable you to do this.
Well, we introduced a technique for measuring the movements of these hairs. Because the movements are less than the wavelength of light, and if you can't just look at them through a microscope. So what we did is we projected an image of the hairs onto a pair of photodiodes. It's a very simple piece of apparatus, actually, onto a pair of photodiodes, and the photodiodes are connected. One is subtracted from the other. So as the hairs move, the shadow of these hairs then moves across the pair of photodiodes. So one of the photodiodes gets brighter and the other one gets dimmer, and if you take the difference between the two, it gets rid of the noise and you get an electrical signal that's directly proportional to the movement. And we can measure movements down to 1 nanometer using this method. And that's how we did it. We measured the movements of the hairs using this method. In isolated preparations, that is, not in the intact cochlea, but...
That's fascinating that you'd be able to catch this kind of speed or have this sensitivity.
Yeah, and they work very fast, of course. Photodiodes are very fast, so you're not limited by the speed of the...
That's amazing. So in this area of research, You've worked with in the Kavli Award. You've fit in this. You were one of several researchers that were recognized here for groundbreaking research. How do these discoveries fit in with the bigger picture? I mean, the other advances that we've seen just in the last years.
Do you mean what do the other people do? I mean the thing that we did is we recorded the movements of the hares and the electrical responses of the hares in different kinds of animals, and we helped Christine Petit. She was a geneticist, so she found these different humans with genetic disorders, genetic deafnesses, that she could tie to single proteins, and we showed her how to record from the hair cells, and particularly in mice, that we could insert the same mutation in. Jim Hudspeth had also done work, but he didn't do any electrical recordings later of the responses.
That's quite a international collaboration with Pettit, and she's in from France,
he's
I believe,
France, right?
Right. Yeah. And Hudspeth, I read that he's in New York.
He's in the Rockefeller. Yes, yes.
Should we talk about some of the advances or the applications of where this this new research will go, or what's the next frontier in this, or what are the challenges that you're going to go to?
Well, I mean, one of the things that we're interested in, and everybody's doing this for, is to understand hearing loss. So hearing loss, there are really two major causes of hearing loss. One is genetic. So children are born with mutations in proteins that are involved in sound detection. It's involved in the hair cells. And there's about 2 in 1,000 children born, and they're deaf. So if there's any protein, aberrant protein present, the cells die and they're deaf. So we were interested in why that was, and would it give us some insight into the mechanism, the molecular mechanisms? I mean, this is something that Christine Petit started, and the molecular mechanisms, and what were the molecules? Because there are very small numbers of cells, so you can't use biochemistry on the cochlea. You can't work out the proteins present are, because there are too few cells to do any sort of biochemistry on them. So you have to use genetics. So, I mean, that's one aspect of it, to understand the hearing loss, what the origin of it is, can you do anything about it? And you know, which cells are affected? Are they the high frequency cells, the low frequency cells, or all of the cells? Now, the other kind of hearing loss is the loss due to some environmental problem. And there are various environmental problems, but of course the main one is noise. Loud sounds will kill the hair cells. You go to a rock concert and you come out with your ears ringing. So some of that will be reversible and some of it won't be. And when it's not, it's because the cells have not recovered and will die. That tends to happen with higher frequency cells. You can really map this well and show that the higher frequency cells are the most sensitive. And that's really not understood. Why is that? So kind of related to this, of course, is when the cells die, they don't regenerate. So why don't they regenerate? This is a really important question. Cells in the chicken regenerate if you kill them. Cells in mammals do not regenerate. And I guess an adjunct of that, of course, is that the old people, as you get older, then you lose your hearing. A lot of people lose their hearing. Half of people over 70 have some hearing defect. I mean, it's possible that a lot of that is just related to a lifetime of noise. But there's a point I do want to mention, and that is particularly with older people, you get... So the hair cell actually connects to the auditory nerve fiber. It makes synapse on the auditory nerve fiber. Now, it doesn't synapse on just one. It will synapse on about 20 auditory nerve fibers. But with age and with noise exposure, some of those auditory nerve fibers die. So it might be reduced from 20 down to 10 or 5. Associated with that, you don't see any change in your threshold. You can still hear soft sounds, but it affects your ability to understand and see the localization, find the localize the sound in space. I mean, this is one of the questions. It makes them very difficult to understand conversation in background sounds. And this is not due to death of hair cells, it's due to death of the nerve fibers.
Okay. All right, yeah, this is one thing I know many people have complained about, or as they get older, it's not so much, yeah, they can't differentiate. If there's the background noise, it's just is more difficult to get through than when they were younger.
Yes, actually. Yes.
Now, should we mention? Let's say there's a lot of different hearing questions I kind of have for you about. I don't know if these are appropriate, but the ringing in the ears that people experience, is that?
I could make a comment about that. Tinnitus. It's a ringing in the ears. It comes and goes at a particular frequency. It's not understood where it comes from. It's usually associated with death of hair cells. So you lose some hair cells at one particular place in the cochlea. The brain thinks the hair cells are still there, so it generates an internal sound. This is rather analogous to the phantom limb. You know, if somebody loses a limb, they still believe it's there and they believe it's painful. And this is generated in the brain. And I think that's what tinnitus is. And I don't know how you solve it. You solve it sometimes by masking. You put a background noise on that is similar to the sound and masks it. You avoid stress. But you had an article from NPR, which was actually a good summary of the approaches to dealing with tinnitus.
Okay. Well, let's move on then. There's all issues people have asked me also about vertigo. Is this something that is related to the hairs in the or is this a different part of the ear as well?
So these are normally related to what's called the vestibular part of the inner ear, and the crucial components there are things called semicircular canals. So there are three semicircular canals that are pointed at 90 degrees to each other that detect movements of the head. And these movements are detected by small calcium particles over the hairs in these three canals. If these calcium particles come loose, you move your head and they'll wander around the semicircular fluid and they wreak some havoc, and that's paroxysmal positional vertigo that causes vertigo.
Okay, and then it does help to not drink too much as well here. I think
yes, because alcohol goes into this fluid and it changes its density. That's the reason. And so that also confuses the ear.
And that's how people get tipsy. Yeah.
It's how people feel the room is spinning round after they've drunk too much.
Okay.
That's a fluid of a property when I was younger. I don't see that anymore.
Okay. Let's move on then. A lot of people, I mean, if they look forward to what they can do, it sounds like, hearing aids are one thing people are looking at. It sounds like some quiet therapy to help yourself regenerate personally. But are there things that people can do for, as far as hearing as they get older, what they would consider? Is there any action they can take to try to improve their situation in this, or are they at the mercy of the market?
Well, the hearing aid, well, they'll be prescribed, audiologists will prescribe a hearing aid and or two, the one in each ear. They'll test their thresholds, and then they'll the hearing aids, they will be programmed for the loss of different frequencies. So if you have a loss at high frequencies, they're little amplifiers, you see. So they'll amplify the sound at high frequencies, but not at low frequencies. And each hearing aid has to be kind of tuned to your, is thought to be tuned to your frequency loss. But of course, they're very expensive, and a lot of people just want some amplification, and you can get this at a cost which is less than the cost of hearing aids, the very expensive hearing aids. And,
okay. Well, yeah, thank you. I just, you know, this is a fascinating field that's really growing, and as you know, I'm not. How did you ever happen in this field, or what would you do to recommend others to enter into this?
To enter in this field?
Yes.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I got into it because the people in Cambridge where I started, there was a very famous man there called Hodgkin, Alan Hodgkin, and he worked out how the action potential works in the nerve fibers, and he advised us, and he worked on photoreceptors, and I did a little work on photoreceptors in the eye photoreceptors. In fact, I worked on the photoreceptors in the turtle, which is how I got on the turtle in the first place. And then I thought, well, this field is all done, and I need a new field. So I moved to hearing. That's how I got into it. Well, I thought of moving to some other sensory system. The sensory systems are a really interesting part of the brain because you know what their stimulus is normally. So you can understand their how they're specialized to do a particular job. If you record from a nerve cell in the middle of the brain, you often don't know what its normal input is. So you can't understand what it's doing. It's a big barrier. So that's how I got into it. And I'm an electrophysiology, so I make electrical recordings. And I don't think people, I'm not sure that students are very interested in this anymore. They're interested in sort of brain imaging, you know, MRIs, and can we figure out which bit of the brain is interested in emotion and which bit of the brain is interested in language. And that's valid, but it's a different approach, but electrophysiology on single cells is hard. I'm not sure I would recommend anybody getting into it.
Oh, well, it's a wonderful blend of biology and physics and chemistry, and the hybrid. I got to think there's a lot of opportunity for hybrid science.
That's correct.
For people to look across technology and scientific areas. So, well, I want to say thank you very much for joining us today. This has been most enlightening.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Okay. And to our audience, thank you for hearing us tonight. We've been speaking with Robert Fetteplace from UW Neuroscience. I've been your host, Patrick Seibel, on this edition of Perpetual Notion Machine. Have a great night.